Thank you. You're going to thank me because the urgent announcement I was asked to make was about the main dish for the harvest party. There will be chicken and hot dogs being served, and so your side dishes should, you know, be the appropriate accompaniment of such fare. Bring the right accoutrement, right? All right. I was sitting here sensing and feeling the same thing that our worship leaders were sensing and feeling. And I was asking God, like, why can't I feel this all the time, every time? Why can't it be like this everywhere? And then I didn't hear him give me a good answer, so I stopped listening for that question. And I asked him, what are you trying to do here today? And I don't know exactly where all of that is going to lead, but the content that we're going to be combing through today is pretty deep. Like, your boots won't even help you. You need, like, neck waders, right? Because we're wading into the deep end of the Sermon on the Mount today. And we're going to be covering a lot of ground quickly. And so I think what I want to say, what I'm taking away from our moment in worship there that I pray would just kind of continue along with us today, is this sense of his presence being tender and gentle with us. Because, the words of Jesus aren't always tender and gentle. And really, the Sermon on the Mount, the series we've been in called Rethink, which is asking us to sort of look again at our beliefs and our worldview based on our beliefs. If you've been around the last few weeks, you know that some of these things that Jesus is saying sort of shake us, sort of ask us to challenge what we've been thinking. And that is going to continue today. We had the children last week teach us very well what it meant to be salt and light, what it meant to bring, not only bring a flavor to the world around us, but bring out the flavors that are already there, because that's what salt does, and to be light in the darkness, and there's no need to further that illustration. What it looks like to live a life that's like that for the people around us. So they taught us very well what that looks like. And the next section of scripture in the Sermon on the Mount talks, Jesus has this relationship with what he calls the law, which is sort of the religious preoccupation of the day. These experts in the law are sort of running society. And so Jesus makes a comment right before we get to the material we're going to jump into today, where he says that I did not come to abolish the law, to get rid of. Think of like the Old Testament. Think of like the Ten Commandments, right? That kind of law. He says, I didn't come to abolish it. Instead, I came to fulfill it. And so I just want to hold that up for us today as we launch into this content. Many people look at the Sermon on the Mount and see it as Jesus' teaching about the law. It's his version of the Ten Commandments, if you will. There's so much about it. 40 years in the wilderness for Israel, then the Ten Commandments on the mountain, 40 days of temptation for Jesus, and then he sits down on the mountain, the Sermon on the Mount, right, and begins to talk about the law, begins to talk about how to live in the kingdom. So he says, I didn't come to get rid of it. Instead, he says, I came to fulfill it. And this word fulfill has this really interesting word picture for us. It has this sort of connotation of filling it to the full. So think of your favorite glass at home that you know, your juice, your water, whatever it is you're pouring into it, filling it all the way up to the top, right? So that there's not another drop that can go in. So this glass is completely full. This is sort of the picture that Jesus is relating. I came to fulfill the law, to fill it up all the way, which gives us this understanding then that it wasn't yet completely full. You with me so far? Jesus is like, you had this understanding of the law, and it wasn't complete. So I have actually come to clear up the misunderstandings. I have come to color in the areas that have previously been left kind of blank, or the sort of the missing pieces. I've come to fill it in. And that is what Jesus' words are right before he launches into this next section of content, which I said earlier was pretty deep. Because The Beatitudes that we checked into the last few weeks were kind of just the introduction to the Sermon on the Mount, just the introduction to this thing that Jesus is doing, filling up the law and filling in our understanding and correcting misunderstandings. That was just the introduction, and now we're getting into the meat of it, which include a ton of actual behaviors, a ton of actual things that we see ourselves and other people doing around the planet, right? So put on your neck waders, right? Up to your neck, because chances are this is going to touch you somewhere, somehow, right? You will have experienced this in your life in some way, the things that Jesus is talking about. So today, because we're moving through a lot of stuff, I've chosen to do something different, and that is we're going to start at the bottom. We're going to start at the end of a text, the next section of Matthew 5, and we're going to work our way back to where we stopped last time. Sounds weird to you? I know it was a little weird for me to consider, but as I looked at it a little bit, I think it's going to really help us land this plane in kind of a clear manner, okay? So we're going to jump in starting at Matthew 5, verse 43. There we are. So we're entering into this section of the Sermon on the Mount where there's a bunch of things that we get directly from the law, and then Jesus changes it, right? You've heard it said, but I tell you this. That's the pattern we're going to be experiencing. This is the glass that was partially full. Now I'm going to fill it up. I'm going to fill in your understanding. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, this wasn't in the Ten Commandments, in case you're wondering. In fact, actually, this statement isn't anywhere in the written law of Israel. But you might recognize it as kind of a natural law that all of humanity has kind of been taught. You with me so far? Love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. Right? Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But Jesus goes on to this, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. You've heard it said, love your neighbor, but hate your enemies. Who's your enemy, by the way? Audience participation is welcome. If you want to indict yourself now, who's your enemy? Could be rhetorical if no one says anything. Okay, someone from that team up north, if you're an Ohio State fan, the Pittsburgh Steelers fans, if you're a Browns fan, political people on a different end of a political spectrum, I've heard. What else? People who persecute you? Yes, that feels like an enemy, right? Someone who's against what you're for, right? Kind of a basic definition that feels like it. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Okay? But I tell you, love your enemies. Love the Pittsburgh Steelers fans. Love the people that are against what you're for. Love the people who are against you. Raise your hand if you find that to be completely natural and you're really good at it and it happens every day. I'm really good at loving Steelers fans. You should know that. Steelers fans. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. I want to spend enough time here at the end because this section actually summarizes all the lessons that come before it through all the specific behaviors that we're going to dip into. Causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, sends the rain to the righteous and the unrighteous. What does that sound like to you? What's that? You hear some echoes of Job there? The good and the evil, right? The light and the dark, the righteous and the not righteous, all treated the same? The sun comes up and sets, the rain falls on everyone's fields, right? So how does God treat people? How is it that we see God treating folks, righteous and unrighteous, equally? Gives his love and provision the same. So I checked in on this word love because, you know, it's one of those loaded ones in the English language. And this word love is used here is the very same one that we've heard of before that's all about seeking someone's highest good regardless. I want to say that again. Seeking someone's highest good, their greatest benefit, what's good for them, their best, regardless of what they've done to you, for you, regardless of what they have done against you, regardless of what they forgot to do, regardless of what they failed to do, seeking someone's highest good regardless. This is that same word love. But I tell you, seek everyone's highest good, especially and including your enemies. People that oppose you, people that are for the things you're against, people that hurt you, people that bring you harm. Pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven, the text says. So before we move on from here, we've just discovered what I think and what many people look at as the summarizing point of the text that rests above it in the actual order that it's written in Scripture, the text that we're going to go backwards up through here in a second, and that's this idea that unrestricted love, unconditional love, we've called it from time to time, is the point. I have a friend in my life, we are very different from one another. And when we sign off, whether it's an email or a phone call or a text, or we've spent time together and we've debated these points, or we've kind of wrestled with the ideas of how we're different, we've landed in this place where one or the other of us will say it first, I love you regardless. And it's kind of playful, but there's a depth to it that's captured me, and I want us to hold on to this as we zoom back through these other pieces of Scripture. That you may be called the children of your Father in heaven. This unrestricted love is indeed a mark of who we are as citizens of the heaven, of the kingdom of heaven. You catching this? Advance. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? This is Jesus explaining this. Are not even the tax collectors doing that? These are the most hated people in society, right? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Instead, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. And this perfection that's included in the context is be perfect in the way that you love. Be perfect in the way that you love regardless. This is a mark of a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. This is what a disciple's life is characterized by. You will be called the Father's children if you love this way. Be perfect as he is perfect in the way that he loves, equally the same, regardless. I cannot think of a harder word to hear from Jesus, personally. At the foundation of all of this. But I can also not think of a more powerful thing to experience in my life and in the lives of others than to be loved regardless. So Jesus starts off, actually, he closes this section with this, but it is the key to understanding everything that comes next. So let's keep moving. That went really far. All right, can you give me one more, Dale? Thank you. I think, yes. So let's talk about this idea of retaliation, which seems to be a part of this natural law, right? Loving our neighbors, but hating our enemies, right? That's like the natural way. But Jesus is talking about life in the kingdom and what it looks like to follow him and be called one of his brothers and sisters. So he says this, you've heard it said, long ago, it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You've heard this before? So this, we know, this part of the law was delivered to Moses to sort of restrict retaliation. Because actually, if we're honest, natural law is like, you punch me and I kick you. You steal a dollar, I burn your house to the ground, right? That's like, it got dark quick, right? But that's our human nature. That is the nature of retaliation. And so what we hear when we dip into the Old Testament, into the law that was handed down, is this eye for an eye was sort of to restrict, to minimize over, like disproportionate responses. Why? Because God knows that we would probably overdo it every time. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Now, at some point along the way, we know in sort of the Israelite culture, it wasn't just sort of a limiter, but this actually became sort of the prescription. Like, you had no choice. If someone knocked out your tooth, you took theirs or their eye, etc. And there's this whole amazing group of texts in Jewish culture that describes what you need to pay back for what. It's phenomenal to look into. We don't have time to do it, but maybe someday we'll put that information out there so you can read through. Like, what happens if I bump into your ox cart and your ox breaks its ankle? And oh my goodness, like really specific. What happens? But we're talking about retaliation. Jesus says, you've heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Oh no. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. Guys, if you can use your imagination for a minute. So this is my right cheek, right? If you were going to hit me in my right cheek, how would you do it? Slap, right? You'd slap me, right? But if you're right-handed, which most people are, how's that going to work? The backhand. The backhanded slap is usually reserved for what? Humiliation. I challenge you to a duel, yes? Right? So picture this. Jesus is saying, you've heard it said, if someone hits you, you whatever, you blow them up, right? But he says, instead, I tell you, don't resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. How many of you are comfortable with that idea? This person comes to you and humiliates you. And instead of fighting back, what happens? You give him the other side. Now, before we reach into the next section of the text, what are you thinking? What does that do in that moment? What's that? You get slapped twice. She's a pragmatist, right? We appreciate you for that, right? You get slapped twice. Maybe. What else might happen? Might take the wind out of their sails, like you meant to humiliate me, but it didn't work. Why? Because I've chosen vulnerability. I've chosen to love you regardless. I've chosen not to erase you from existence. The mark of a disciple, of a citizen of the kingdom of heaven is to love regardless, not retaliating, but instead offering up deeper humiliation for yourself. Sounds like what it looks like on the surface, but it could be a curative, right? It could be something that sets the person back, gives them a pause, gives them a reason to check their behavior. Jesus continues, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. Oh my gosh, Jesus, come on, please. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile with them, which was a law back then under Roman occupation, go with them 2 miles carrying the soldier's armor. Give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. And you can kind of like project this further to any number of other ridiculous things. I don't know that Jesus is suggesting that this kind of behavior would go to the like legislative like level of influence in our culture, but it certainly should be true of the individual. This certainly should look like this. If God loves us regardless, if God withholds retaliation regardless, and we are to be perfect in our loving regardless, as God is perfect loving regardless, then this is what it looks like. We treat other people the same way that God treats us. I told you, Jesus is getting deep, like he's messing around in our life now. Before it was just a concept, and now he's describing our own behavior and things that could actually and have actually happened to us. If the unworthy, and that's you and me, have experienced grace and mercy in the kingdom, this is how we should treat others. You guys done? Like that's enough for the day, right? But he keeps going, and we're going to keep going. Can you just give me the next slide? Please, thank you. And again, you've heard that it was said to the people long ago, don't break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows that you have made. Oaths, vows, promises are a big deal, right? We talk about covenants. Oaths are wrapped up in that whole idea. This is the most important sort of transaction almost in human relationships, oaths. Don't break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. Next slide, please. But I tell you, don't swear an oath at all, because he knows we stink at it, right? We couldn't keep our covenant. The whole Old Testament is evidence of this, right? And in our lives, we have plenty of evidence of this. Don't swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by earth, for it's his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the holy city of the great king. And don't swear by your own head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. You are writing checks that you are not able to cash, that you just cannot, you can't keep this, so cut it out. Jesus, in his explanation of the law and his filling up of our understanding, seems to include this sort of openness to the idea that we're human and we're going to mess up. And so he's putting guardrails on our behavior, right? He's giving us pictures of what it looks like to live as a citizen of the kingdom, founded in this idea of loving others regardless. And at the foundation of this idea of oaths, gosh, is this sense that if I have to swear an oath, right, if I have to bring God into this, then maybe there's something in my character that you're questioning. If we have to write a contracts are all based around relationships that don't have trust at their foundation, right? We have contracts because we have to stipulate what happens if you don't do this or I don't do that, right? Loving people regardless. If we live with integrity, oath-taking is unnecessary. Can you give me the next slide? All you need to say is simply yes or no, and anything beyond this comes from the evil one, right? This goes back to this idea of the temptations that we have to get what we want. We use our rightness or our power or our effectiveness or relevance to the relationship, right? Jesus is really piling it on here. If you just live with integrity, if you just say yes or no, you're living with love, both for yourself and for the other in the context of this relationship. Let it be yes or no. Anything else comes from the evil one. So in the kingdom, a person's word can be relied upon without qualification or need for further guarantee. Again, has to be rooted in this idea of loving regardless, being willing to say, I'm going to keep my commitment whether you keep yours or not. Man, what a different existence Jesus is describing for us. Oh boy, here comes the next one. If you can give it to me. It's been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. Now hold right there. This refers back directly to a section in Deuteronomy where this idea of a certificate of divorce is being delivered. There's evidence that women could initiate back then, but it was largely dominated by men initiating divorce. And in the context of this section, it literally says, for any reason that he's displeased with her, he can issue a certificate of divorce. That doesn't sound like loving the other regardless, right? That doesn't sound like a foundation for this sort of kingdom experience. And the certificates of divorce looked like, you're free to do whatever you want now, and you're free to do whatever you want now, and now this thing never happened and we're all good. You've heard it said that that's the way to do it. Next slide, though. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And oh my goodness, now the complex web of human relationships all around us has just gotten weird and nasty. So the cultural sort of underpinning of this, women in that culture, they needed, because of the culture and the rules and the social norms around them, they had to be connected to a man. First their father, then to a husband, in order to survive, in order to eat and have a roof over their head. And so if you cut her loose for any reason that displeased you, she now had to do whatever she had to do to survive, which looked like remarrying or prostituting herself, which the Old Testament and New Testament is fraught with those kinds of stories. This is the culture that Jesus is speaking into. And he seems to be speaking into it in a way that gives this way out. There's a lot of questions around what sexual immorality is and what is the real meaning of the word that's used in the original language. And we don't have to get into that at all, because the underpinning character of this conversation is to love the other regardless. Jesus says, man, you got to stop this. First of all, he's sort of attacking this male-dominated, sort of patriarchal, misogynistic way of treating women. Boom, I said that out loud. Number two, he seems to be saying, hey, there is actually a permanent characteristic of the bond of marriage, and you ought not to take it so lightly. Allowing for the fact that we're still going to screw up, that we're still going to mess up, that we still live in a fallen and broken world. But Jesus is still describing for us the kingdom of heaven, the ideal of the kingdom of heaven. So in the kingdom of heaven, divorce, no. In the kingdom of heaven, list all the reasons people get divorced, and none of those are happening either. Does that make sense? The ideals of behavior are on both sides of this. There's a corrective to all of that. And well, we could go really deep into this part of the conversation. I know a lot of people talk to me, ask me questions about this, and we don't have the opportunity to do that today, but here's what I would say. If this behavior has been a part of your reality in some way, you know that the fracturing of this bond, no matter how it comes, is awful. It's awful. And it completely undermines this idea of choosing vulnerability. It completely undermines this concept of loving the other regardless. So even if we're hung up, feelings of shame or guilt, that's actually not the point that Jesus is making here. He's saying in the kingdom, there's no reason for this. In the kingdom, we let our yes be yes and our no be no, and our behavior follows through, and there's no need. I don't know about you, but I think that sounds like an amazing way to live. I'd prefer to be in that environment myself. Jesus says if we do so, we would be called the children of God. Let's go on, shall we? You've heard it said, oh no, don't commit adultery. One of the Ten Commandments, pretty straightforward. Well, Jesus takes it and he fills it up even more. So let's go to the next slide. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You're kidding me. Again, the inner thoughts and the inner life of the person, their motivation, it matters as much as their behavior. Jesus says they've already committed adultery in their heart. And the verses that follow describe sort of like there's judgment involved in this. And in the interest of time, we're going to kind of push past that. Like if your right eye causes you to stumble, because that's how you're taking in this idea, then pluck it out, right? If your right hand causes you to sin, then cut it off. Like better you to enter into the kingdom blinded and without a hand than to suffer the judgment of a life that's consumed by this. If we read this literally, as people did, we'd all be missing some things. But Jesus fills this up and deepens it because he's sort of saying, well, if you take out your right eye, which is actually the language, that's like your dominant eye for most people. That's the understanding of the writer. If you cut off your right hand, it's your dominant hand, you're actually limiting your power. You're actually reducing yourself. And this sort of this idea here that the problem is the stumbling block, yes, but it's speaking more to your inner thought life and what's going on inside of you as being such a strong driver of your behavior, but also your life in the kingdom. That we need to tend to it seriously. Pluck out your eye, cut off your hand. All right, this is all kinds of fun, right? Well, we're almost done. Yay! Let's talk about murder now, shall we? You've heard that it was said to people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. All right, like, don't kill nobody. Next slide. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Angry. Just angry. Again, speaking to the inner life, speaking to the condition of the heart. Remember, the foundation of this section and really the mark of a disciple is to love regardless, to seek the other's highest good, their best, their well-being, regardless. And Jesus throws murder into this pile, and he's like, see, how does this fit? Now, even being angry opens you up to judgment. So here is this curative. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, so let's talk like worship service, right? If you're going to go sing, clap your hands, right? If maybe bring a sacrifice, your offering, your tithe, whatever, your gift of service. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar and first go and be reconciled to them and then come and offer your gift. If the foundational mark of a citizen of the kingdom of heaven is to love regardless. Jesus is describing this idea of reconciliation, right? Of restoration, of a return, a restoration of intimacy as so critical that you, it's more important that you do that than sing the song, than drop the check, than serve in that ministry. In fact, all the rest of it is kind of meaningless unless you're living into this life, standing on this foundation of unrestricted love, unconditional love. I love you regardless. First, go and be reconciled to them, and then come and offer your gift. So again, the inner attitude's super important. Our behavior reflects what's inside. This is what it looks like to live out our Christian life. This is just a small sliver of behaviors. We're going to get into some more in the next couple of weeks. Causes us to rethink, doesn't it? Some of the postures we've had towards people, some of the thoughts we've allowed ourselves to persist in. So, I'm going to invite the band up on this happy note. Spirit breakout, that the words of that last song that we dwelled in seems to be the curative, right? Seems to be the thing that underpins us. So, one of the things super helpful in my life, and I'm going to leave you with this today. I'm going to leave you with this today, telling you that I don't get any of this stuff right all the time. I get angry, right? Fill in the blank, right? I'm a human being. But here's the thing that has landed for me and has been helpful for me. And it's going to sound super easy and super almost cliche to you, but when I'm about to be angry, when I feel the temptation of lust coming on, this is a gift that's been given to me. This idea of looking at the person who either opposing me or whatever, and look at them as if they were made in the image of God. This person that borrowed something and didn't return it and it was important to me. Look at them as if they were made in the image of God. This person that hurt me deeply, and I'm not sure I can ever get over what they've done. Look at them as if they were made in the image of God. You can call it a trick. I don't know. I consider it almost like a spiritual discipline because all of us are going to face these things, right? All of us are experiencing these things. Jesus isn't just picking random stuff. He's picking stuff that affects all of us. My encounter with this, to look at this person as if they were made in the image of God, somehow preserves my heart. Somehow redirects my mind to go, okay, oh my gosh, okay, that's actually the divine right in front of me, broken and twisted, and yes, okay, how do I relate now? How do I look at her that way now? How do I treat him that way now? You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemies. But I tell you to love your enemies, bless them, turn the other cheek. Seek their highest good, whatever that means. You will be called children of the Father, brothers and sisters of King Jesus, whose kingdom we are citizens of. Let me pray.